This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3598, for Wednesday, the 18th of May, 2022. Today's show is entitled Slackware 15 32-bit Operating System from Day 1. It is hosted by ZenFloater 2 and is about 63 minutes long. It carries an explicit flag. The summary is the pros of using a Slackware 32-bit operating system.
Hello, boys and girls, from your favorite magical forest squirrel, former human being converted into squirrel in the 1960s by aliens, here for another podcast and on Hacker Public Radio. And I think what our subject today is going to be Slackware Linux and why I'm using it right now. Why do squirrels like Slackware Linux? Well, if we go to the wiki on the internet that covers the subject of Slackware, we see that Slackware was first introduced in April of 1993. I happened to get involved with it when I walked into a large computer store, the size of a grocery store, in the Houston, Texas area. And I think it was the fall of 93. And they had come up with a box set of Slackware for, I don't know, it's around $100. And I bought it because at that time I was beginning to work with a lot of Unixes, and SCO was one of the Unixes that we were working with commercially in business ventures. And I thought it would be cool if I could have my own lease of Unix. But I didn't realize at that time that Slackware was based on Linux and not Unix, and the two are different. It was part of my learning lesson. That was also the time that I learned, at the beginning of the 90s, how to get on the internet. And that was with DOS and Windows at the time, Windows 3.11. So trying to get Slackware Linux on the internet was quite an experience till I found out about a program called WVDAL, which made it easy. But let's see, I still have that box set of original Slackware here around here somewhere. I think it's out in the garage in one of the boxes. But at any rate, version 1 was released on 1993, July 17th. And it had kernel version 0.99.11 alpha. And I was thinking I either got that one or the 99.13 kernel with version 1.1. I don't really remember. It could have been 1.1. It was a long time ago. I'll have to go see if I can find that box and look that up sometime, because it's still sitting out there. You know, Slackware is nearly 30 years old. It will be 30 years old come April of next year in 2023. All right, in 1994, July 2nd, they released version 2 of Slackware with a 1.09 kernel. Slackware 2.1 was released in 94 in October 31st. Again, a 1.1.59 kernel was released on that. And let's see, here's version 2.2 in 1995, March 30th, with a 1.2.1 kernel. These are the very early days, and Slackware 2.3 was released in 95. And we progressed forward. I won't read through all these, there's just so many of them. By 1999, in October 25th, we were up to Slackware 7. And then we're finally at the 2.2.13 kernel. And I remember running a lot of 2.2 and 2.4 kernels back in those days. Those are very interesting days, down there 20 years ago. Well, over 20 years ago, actually, now, isn't it? Let's see. We move forward. It was in the 90s when Patrick Volkerdink, the owner and producer of Slackware, moved from version 4 he released in 1999 on May 17th all the way to version 7 on 1999 October 25th because he felt the version numbers weren't reflecting the progress of Slackware compared to other distributions. It was a marketing decision. So you won't find a Slackware 5 or a 6 in the reference. Then we move forward to Slackware 10, which is released in 2004, June 23rd, and that had a 2.4.26 kernel. Moving forward to Slackware 11, released in 2006, October 2nd, still with a 2.4.33.3 kernel. There was quite a long span there of 2.4 kernels from version 8.1 of Slackware all the way up to version 11. They were all using the same kernel 2.4 series. Then with version 12, they went to a 2.6.21.5 kernel in 2007 in July at first. And moving forward, we'll just jump forward to Slackware 13.37, released in April 27th of 2011, and he jumped to a 2.6.17 kernel. Or no, 2.6.37, excuse me, I can't read. Kernel. This is all from the wiki. Slackware 14 was released in 2012, and the 14 series was 14, 14.1, and 14.2. And 14 was released in 2012, September 28th, with a 3.2.29 kernel. And we finally got out of the 2 series of kernels, went to the 3. And I remember that was a big deal when they jumped from the 2X to the 3 series kernels. And then with 14.2, he had a 4.4.14 kernel, which was the last Slackware we all ran some 4 years ago. And, 6 years ago. 2016 was when 14.2 was released in June 30th of 2016. So, that was quite a long time ago, wasn't it? And of course, now we're on Slackware 15. That has jumped to a 5.15.19 kernel, Linux kernel. And it has FFmpeg in it now, so we don't have to compile FFmpeg anymore. There's been so many improvements to it. The distribution is over 3.5 gigs, the DVD size, approaching 4 gigs in size, probably with the next release, I'm sure. And he's thrown everything but the kitchen sink into this. I mean, it's almost like installing Ubuntu or something. I mean, everything's in here. There's very little left to compile. So we asked the question, what has Slackware done in almost 30 years of existence? Slackware being the oldest surviving, still produced Linux distribution. It wasn't the first. There were, I think, two of them before it. SLS and Dragon something or another. I can't remember. I read about it in the 90s. That there was some other Linux distribution. But they're both gone now. So Slackware is the oldest surviving Linux distribution. And in nearly 30 years' time, Slackware still uses a very simplistic text file-based operating system that uses BSD scripts or BSD-like scripts. You know, no one can claim the right of ownership of what is a BSD init script. I mean, because if you look at being a BSD user, an OpenBSD user anyway, OpenBSD has their own, NetBSD has their own, and so does FreeBSD. And I don't think there was ever a time when you could go back there and say, well, this was what a BSD script is. What we're talking about is init scripting that existed prior to SysV init, System 5 init, that isn't still in use today. And SISB init is unique and separate from the BSD init system. You know, SISB init's what Debian used to use and Red Hat used to use back in the 90s. So, Slackware tries to remain as much unchanged from its original release in April of 1993 as possible. Over the years, it has added things to the system, and I have a list of things that were added here in the wiki. For instance, in version 3.0 of November 30th of 1995, Slackware finally transitioned from an AOUT executable and linkage format ELF to an executable and linkage format ELF in version 3.0, which was in 1995. And I can remember working with that in my house when I was learning Slackware and learning the C language. Slackware added KDE to its distribution on May 17th, 1999 with version 4. They added the GNOME desktop with version 7.1 on June 22nd of 2000. They added the Mozilla browser with Slackware version 8 in July 1st of 2001. Let's see what else. Oh, they switched from the OSS sound system to ALSA in September 26th of 2003 with version 9.1. They switched from the X86 server to the Xorg server for your desktop applications with Slackware 10 released in June 23rd of 2004. Then in with Slackware 10.2 in September 14th of 2005, they removed GNOME. So GNOME had been in there from June 22nd of 2000 to September 14th of 2005, ending with Slackware 10.2, because Patrick just couldn't keep up with it. You know, it was getting to be too much of a problem, too much of a mess. And, you know, with as much effort as they put into keeping KDE Plasma in Slackware, I'm surprised that hasn't been pulled too, frankly. The first release offered of Slackware on DVD, in other words, they moved from CD-ROMs to DVD. And originally, by the way, when I bought my box of Slackware, the very first box, it had install floppies, but it also had a CD-ROM. You could install from a CD-ROM. So I considered that to be really modern for the day, you know, back in 1993, the fall of 93. I mean, I thought that was ultra cool because they just came out with the CD-ROM technology for computers, I believe that year, or, you know, pretty close to that year. That was back in an era where everybody built their own vanilla PC, because if you went to Dell or Compaq or IBM to buy one, you're going to shell out $6,000. And I didn't have that kind of cash back then, and very few people did. And if you did have that kind of cash, you were probably running Windows anyway. You didn't give a damn about Slackware. Let's see what else here. With Slackware 13 released in August 26th of 2009, they added 64-bit version. I guess they finally offered a 64-bit version of Slackware and switched from KDE 3.5 to the 4X series. So Slackware makes little movements in desktops and stuff like that. And of course, a major move going to a 64-bit version. They'd been 32-bit before that. Let's see. They offer GPT disk support and the Butter file system, BTRFS, with Slackware 1337, which was released on April 27th of 2011. And Slackware 1337, that was a very special, mystical version number that Patrick picked for that release based on his, I don't want to call it religious belief, but whatever. They added the network manager and removed HAL. And I remember HAL, God, that was simply awful. It merged into UDEV with Slackware 14 in September 28th of 2012. So Slackware is very slow moving. You know, network manager, I believe, had been available on Red Hat, if I'm not mistaken, like at the turn of the century or pretty close to it. They've added support for UEFI hardware with Slackware 14.1, released in November 4th of 2013. They added Pulse Audio, finally, with Slackware 14.2. I remember that. That was a big deal, you know, because you were using ALSA before that. And, you know, even OpenBSD doesn't have ALSA yet, but they do have Pulse Audio support. And of course, the current Slackware that has FFmpeg in it and all kinds of video codecs and stuff that used to be illegal to distribute on a Linux distribution, even though we all know for the last 20 years, Red Hat, Ubuntu, and everybody else, you know, throughout time in the last 20 years has been offering VLC, FFmpeg, and everything, even Gentoo, you could just compile it up. So anyway, Slackware is a very slow-moving operating system as far as development goes, compared to the others. So the question comes up, why would anyone want to run Slackware? Well, one of the things that comes to mind is if you're running another distribution like Red Hat, let's say back at the turn of the century, or OpenSUSE or Debian or anything, and let's say they throw out an update that breaks something in your system, well, you're pretty well screwed. And with Slackware, you compile your own applications on the system, and when you compile them, they're there forever. No one's going to touch them. Because the only thing that Slackware updates through its Slack package system is the base operating system. In other words, what came on the DVD that you originally installed. So basically with Slackware, it's like you're riding on a surfboard in Hawaii. The surfboard being what you're standing on, which is Slackware. It is the DVD as you're coming into the beach, and Patrick Volkerdink is supporting that surfboard to make sure it runs right. And anything you bring on board, a cooler, a boombox stereo, a microphone so you can sing out to the crowds as you come in on your wave there in the Hawaiian beach, that's all stuff that you put on Slackware, and it will not be touched by Patrick Volkerdink or the Slackware team. Unlike if you're running Red Hat or OpenSUSE or one of the other distributions, Ubuntu, Debian, that offer you package updates, you see, they do all the work. And you don't do anything. So if they screw up something upstairs and send it downstairs to you, you're stuck with it until they fix it. That's one of the reasons that people run Slackware. Why I like Slackware is not only is it BSD and it's set up like a BSD operating system where you have a base that's supported by different people from the applications, as within OpenBSD, as within NetBSD, as within FreeBSD or Dragonfly. Slackware is the same way. It's perhaps the only Linux distribution that I'm aware of that separates the base operating system from the user's applications in responsibility of who does them. All the other Linux distributions throw all that in one pool. So you're stuck with whatever the, you know, the distribution leaders hand to you. And you need to hope that it works. And if it doesn't, again, you're screwed. Now with Slackware, if something gets screwed up because I compiled something wrong or deleted something or did something wrong, I get to fix it. I own my own operating system above the base operating system. I'm in control of all my applications. So whatever I put on here will always be on here unless I screw it up. I am responsible for my own operating system. And, you know, you can have a Slackware distribution like 14.2 sitting there on a laptop for quite literally 4 or 5 years and be supported. You know, he'll send you patches to the base operating system to keep you your security up for 4 or 5 years, and you can sit there and run that thing that you compiled 4 or 5 years ago, VLC, Audacity, play music, use GPotter, you know, whatever. It's all going to be there for 4 or 5 years because nobody's touching it. It's not moving. It's not going to change. It'll never get broken. And that has worked out just fine. It's worked out fine for a great many people, and they like it that way. They don't want their applications to be updated and broken. You know, if you have a VLC player that's working, why change it? Because really they haven't offered any new functionality in the multimedia for probably 10 years, I'm guessing. And I'm probably going to get some comments over that comment that I just made about VLC. But for the common user, there's no video or audio format that you couldn't play with a player from 10, 12 years ago. Today, you know, if I had a Slackware box set up that I set up in 2007, I could play any MP3 or OGG file or MP4 file that was available then or available today without any problem using that, you know, 12, 13, 14, 50 year old system. So that's one reason why people use Slackware, is you own your own system. You know, you have control of your own system. No one will be kicking over your work that you've done on your operating system. You know, your applications, they won't be interfering with your production because they can't. You're the one that puts the applications on there. They don't. So when you got something set up and it works right, you can keep it for years. Now, Slackware is also one of the first operating systems that I'm aware of that's offered support to the base system for 5 years or more. In fact, I was sitting here looking through the wiki, and they were claiming on some of his versions he'd actually provided patches for 10 years. That's a long time. You know, to offer patches for close to 10 years. I don't think any other Linux distribution has come close to that. You know, to keep your security up and reliability patches, what have you. I happen to have here Slackware 15 installed on a 2007 era IBM Lenovo laptop. This is a really expensive machine. I think I gave a little over $2,000 for it back then, and that was a lot of money. It has an NVIDIA card built into it from back then. Uses the Bumblebee driver. I'm not currently using it at the moment. It has a huge 17-inch screen, very pretty screen. DVD burner, of course, and 3 or 4 USB plugins, and it's got an old ATA drive from the era. You know, it's not a modern drive. It has one of the original track pads with separate left and right clickers on it, and an old mechanical keyboard, just like the original ThinkPads had, only this is in a G series Lenovo laptop product business model. It's got a glass top to it. It's very nice, and it's still in great condition except for the trackpad, which has got some fingernail damages from the squirrel. You know, squirrel claws are hard on a trackpad. But other than that, it's beautifully lit up. There's all kinds of pretty lights on the front of it and on the top of the unit. It has a numeric keypad, a full keyboard on it, It also runs OpenBSD, by the way, perfectly because of the old trackpad, because OpenBSD doesn't work well with I2C trackpads of modern computers. Not yet, anyway. And the I2C controller keyboards and stuff like that. By the way, I tried running the current version of MX Linux 21.1 on here, and I couldn't get it to work with the trackpad. I mean, it would move the mouse a little bit on the screen, but it was really hard to control, and I could tell there was obviously something wrong. And I'm going to just knock that up and say they've got the newer distributions already set up for I2C that are Debian derivatives or Ubuntu derivatives. They're already set up for I2C, so they're not going to run right with the older systems that aren't under I2C, and so that causes a problem. Now, Slackware 15 happens to run beautifully with this old laptop. This modern Slackware 15 runs beautifully, and the trackpad works flawlessly. It's nice and glassy smooth, and it responds to both the click keys and also a tap to the main pad. And I don't have a track point on this. I wish I did. This particular model doesn't have a track point, but if you did, it would be able to handle that as well beautifully. Unfortunately, this old model has a Broadcom-based Wi-Fi in it, which requires a special Win driver that Linux used to support back in 2007. They offered and I forget what they called it, but they had a module that would wrap around a Windows-based binary firmware blob to make it work for Linux, and I believe they've quit supporting that. And so what I have purchased for this laptop is a USB plug-in Wi-Fi antenna. And I don't mean dongle, I mean large antenna, the size of a CB walkie-talkie antenna. It's huge. And it sits here at the edge of the bed. I'm sitting on the bed right now doing this podcast and eating cookies and drinking coffee and Pepsi. And this large antenna gives me excellent range for OpenBSD and for Slackware Linux. I've also chosen personally to install the 32-bit version of Slackware Linux, not the 64, because I don't have any use for and don't like that much the some of the options that you can get with 64-bit. And I don't like the way 64-bit runs, frankly. I think 32-bit's a lot smoother and it runs better. I've had 64-bit on this laptop. You know, it supports the trackpad and everything like you would expect it to. But, you know, as far as flat packs go, I have to ask the question, gee, why do I even need to run flat packs? Perhaps the only thing that you'd get out of it that you couldn't get normally might be support for some of the social websites that people go to, like Discord, which I don't go to. So it's up to you. I mean, if you need support for flat packs, you're going to want to run the 64-bit version of Slackware. But for me, I don't see any use to it. I already have Audacity programmed or compiled on here in a 32-bit mode, and VLC and MPV and everything, even though I didn't need it. GVC View, OBS Studio, all that stuff is already compiled and set up here. And I noticed when I was on 64-bit Slackware with some flat packs, the drop-down controls on things like Audacious wouldn't even drop down. I mean, you click on them and you couldn't access the menu lists. I don't really like flat packs that much. You know, maybe they run better with other operating systems, but I'm not that crazy about flat packs. If you, in Slackware, you know, why install a flat pack when you can just compile what you need? Of course, the other thing that you're going to be missing running a 32-bit Linux distros, you won't be able to run Chrome or Chromium. And for me, I still don't care. And that also means you probably won't be running Brave because it's based on Chromium. But I could compile Pale Moon on here, which is a nice lightweight browser, and Dello. And I was thinking there's one more that we can compile, but I can't remember the name of it right now. I haven't run it in a number of years. But there's at least one more browser that you have an option of compiling that will work under 32-bit. So, yeah, 32-bit software is the same operating system venue that Slackware 1 was released under, the box set that I bought it. Slackware was a 32-bit operating system from day one. So was Linux in general, you know, the kernel. It was 32-bit from day one. And back in 1993, that was also a huge deal because most of us were running Windows. And Windows was, I believe, just a 16-bit operating system at that time. And Windows wasn't really a multitasking, multi-user operating system either, whereas Slackware Linux was multitasking and multi-user from day one in 32-bit, which means you could have more than one person working on the computer through a dumb terminal at the same time you were using it. And it would run multiple programs for each user, and everything would work fine. Which you could never say of anything from DOS and Windows land. That would never be true. It also offered security and separation between the users, which was fantastic for the time. And that's what excited me so much about it, that I loved about it, the possibility of having my own commercial Unix-like operating system at my house, running on a 486 computer, which is what I had back then, which would be kind of slow, and it was slow for Slackware, but it did work, and it was cool. It was very cool. Now, I've got this 32-bit Slackware 15 operating system installed on the Lenovo. One of the sad things about running a 32-bit operating system is the world is trying to phase out 32-bit operating systems now and make them all 64, because all the newer laptops will be UEFI only. And that means that you can't run Slackware 15 32-bit on those machines because you have to run 64-bit to get UEFI support. And you also can't run things like ZFS on 32-bit support. I mean, there is a growing list of software options that are going to be 64-bit only. It's not just Chrome and Chromium and, say, Brave. But there, for instance, the Tor browser for a while there was 64-bit only. But I happen to have the Tor browser, thanks to Slack builds, compiled in 32-bit mode, and it's working on this machine. And I thought they had done away with that, but apparently they didn't. It's you can still get it compiled for 32-bit, and it works just fine. Well, I thought I'd just go through my menu here. I'm running the KDE desktop, and it's Plasma 5. I forget which version, but I want to go through the menu here and just kind of look through the applications. And I won't go through all the development applications. It's about the same development stuff that you found on previous Slackware models, slightly beefed up. There might be a few more items in here that you didn't get from Slackware 14.2. I won't go through them. And the usual number of games. But one thing I did find out interesting, aside from FFmpeg being offered as standard on the new Slackware, which was an absolute no-no on Slackware 14.2 in previous versions because of, you know, the copyright laws and patent laws and all that crap. We find that Patrick Volkerdink has put on here Kden Live. Kden Live is standard. Simple Screen Recorder is standard. You don't have to compile that. There are several video and other MP3, MP4 playing pieces of software, which you've never seen in previous distributions. So there's quite a bit of multimedia codecs that's included with Slackware 15 that we didn't see on previous releases of Slackware. You had to compile your own software if you wanted MP4 support or MP3 support on previous versions of Slackware. And typically most people would use slackbuilds.org as the website to get the sources and recipes for making that software work on Slackware. I've compiled LibreOffice, for instance, on here, and it has the most modern version available, and Calibri's on here, which I installed from their website. YouTube Downloader, I installed from the YouTube Downloader website. So, yeah, it has the most modern, they offer the most modern LibreOffice from Slack Builds that you would find on the new OpenBSD 7.1, which I just installed this week, and I upgraded from 7.0 to 7.1. So OpenBSD doesn't have as much software as Slack Builds does, but everything that they do have is the most modern version you can get. Another thing that I'll note is Patrick apparently added to Slackware 15 as something they call Poor Man's Internet Radio, which I thought was a live internet radio streams program, which is a console-based program that runs in a terminal, and it's very cool, and I was playing with it, and I love to play internet radio. So anyway, that's all set up for you. And I like that program. It's sweet. I use MP3 Blaster, by the way, quite a bit when I play podcasts and stuff. But my typical player, by the way, is XMMS. And XMMS is becoming hard to find in other distributions. And they have all the skins for XMMS. And I've always felt that XMMS was more beautiful than the Audacity, or Audacious, excuse me, a player that they have today to replace it with. And so I still run XMMS. So if you have an old application that you like and you don't want to lose and you want to keep running it, Slackware might be the only way to get it, other than maybe go to Arch, I guess. One other cool thing I found out too while I was upgrading OpenBSD is Slack Builds offer Signify. There's a build for Signify, which came from OpenBSD. So you can get their Signify public keys from OpenBSD and Signify and verify downloads from OpenBSD. You know, your install files and your firmware and everything is all Signified. So you can use that to verify OpenBSD material. You can also use Signify to create your own key and sign your own packages, which Slack Builds could do, or Slackware could do, and have signed and checksummed packages just like Red Hat and Debian would have. Currently, Slack Package is the only way you get upgrades for the base system on Slackware, and I believe that has a checksum to it and a GPG key already. So they have, I guess, basically the functional equipment is equivalent. It's and they've been using that for years. But Signify is just super cool. You can Signify anything. Anyway, I would recommend, I wouldn't turn my nose up at 32-bit Slackware. In fact, I believe that Patrick will make a 32-bit version of Slackware available for several more releases before they finally probably have to drop it, if they ever drop it. In fact, I'm of the belief that there'll probably be some companies that will be making some Pentium class type systems, maybe AMD based, who knows. Certainly within the ARM community, even in the 64-bit ARM, there will be people who will be using operating systems without UEFI. And I'm not that crazy about UEFI. I'm also not that crazy about systemd, and I'll talk about that for a minute. As you all know, systemd took over all the other distributions, with the exception of Gentoo and Void Linux and Slackware. And I think damn little else. Dev1, of course, doesn't use systemd. They give you three options for init systems over there. Sysvinit. What is it? InitRC or something like that. And then the last one is Runit. If you recall, one of the big selling points that they made to us years ago about systemd was that it'll be make it easier for system administrators to control servers, and that the turnaround time for servers would be much faster because systemd boots so much quicker. And I know you're all having a laugh right now as I say that, as I'm having a laugh, because you know, now that 4 or 5 years have gone by, we noticed that virtually all of the operating system providers that provide a Linux with systemd, with the exception of RHEL, I think RHEL's the only one that still does it right. Their boot up times have gotten worse than Slackware 32 here. I can get this box up to a desktop faster than you can get Ubuntu running. And that's because the people that make these operating systems have just quit bothering to tune systemd from release to release when they put them out, and it's become bloated, piggish, and it's a trash truck going up the street. That's what a systemd distribution's like to me nowadays. It's one of their bright ideas that just turned to cow shit. So again, in my opinion, Slackware wins hands down, is still probably the best Linux distribution you can have. Because you're not going to find one, not even with an Arch, that will allow you to have this much control over your operating system. I mean, when Arch does an update, your system will break. Even if it's a package from the AUR, you are helpless until somebody fixes it. Gentoo, same way. Void Linux, they try to test everything that they have, but Void Linux doesn't have the packages that you could put on Slackware. You can use the AUR as a packaging system and make packages for Slackware, by the way. It's possible. People are doing it. You can also install Geeks, the Geeks version that will run as a foreign operating system within your operating system. And I could even run GNOME 3 as a desktop on Slackware, even in the 32-bit version, if I installed Geeks. I may try that again. I did that, 2-3 years ago, and made a video of it on my my video channel. You can also use the ports and packages from NetBSD and install applications that way if you want. You know, compile your own applications. So there's a multitude of ways to do it, including just doing it by hand. You can just download the source code from Git and have at it, Hoss. All of Slackware's package management system is based on a TAR-GZ format. So the binaries go in as a TGZ with install package. And that's how we have accountability for packages installed on Slackware. Really, the system is very primitive, and it hasn't evolved much in over 20 years. It hasn't evolved much, but it works. And it's as good as any of the other distributions packaging systems. Believe it or not, it does everything the other versions packaging systems does. It has a GPG key signed, you know, thing, and it does a checksum. Well, at least it does a GPG signing of the catalog. I don't know if it does it of every package, but every package has a checksum, at least, I'm pretty sure. If they use Signify, they'd have both on everything. And that would work to their advantage. There is a long list over history of Linux distributions that are based on Slackware. First and foremost would be Salix OS, which is an XFCE-based distribution, desktop-based distribution on Slackware that has its own pre-compiled application software database for the users, so they don't have to compile their own software. And it claims here that they have a KDE version, an LXDE, Fluxbox, RepPoison. I don't know if they have all those now or not in 32 and 64-bit versions, but I know for sure they have XFCE. Vector Linux is based on Slackware. ZenWalk is based on Slackware, and that distribution is also XFCE based for desktop, but it uses the SysV init system. I think that's their big difference. There's a whole list of them here. If you just type in list of Linux distributions based on Slackware, a lot of them are dead because a lot of them come and go. For instance, Slacks used to be based on software, and now it's based on Slackware, Slackware, but it's now based on Debian, so it kind of fell off. And then there's Zip Slack and some of the others that have come and gone. I used to use a free software version of the 32-bit Slackware 14.2 called Conache OS, and that has come and gone. The distribution provider decided he wasn't going to do that anymore. There used to be a Free Slacks project that renamed themselves to Freenix, and I don't know if they're coming out with a Slackware 15 based Freenix or not. I saw somebody on their forum asking about it and volunteering to help, but no one responded to him. So I'm assuming that the Freenix project right now, if they're not hip deep in it, maybe it's dead. I don't know. I don't see any activity on their website that indicates that they're working on it. But that was based on Slackware, only it was blob free, you know, a totally free operating system that had no proprietary binaries in it at all. Slackware has a few proprietary packages and blobs that it distributes, which would just barely disqualify it from being a free operating system. It couldn't make the Free Software Foundation's list. So they came up with the idea of coming up with the Free Slacks, Freenix, and Conache OS ideas. We'll see if they bring them back. I know Conache OS is dead. I don't know if Freenix is dead or not. We'll see. Whether you use the 32-bit version of Slackware 15 or the 64, there are instructions on the DVD which will help you create a fully encrypted install on your hard drive to protect your data in case your laptop gets stolen. And also instructions for how to use UEFI computers and install the UEFI partition EF00 to make that work. Slackware is also probably the only distribution that I know of that allows you to make an encrypted install using Luke's LVM and run it with the Butter file system, which is something that I wish Linux Mint would finally come out with, to have an encrypted install that used the Butter file system instead of ext4. And God only knows why they're not doing that, but they're not. Devuan, they only allow installation in ext4, so I guess they're having some issues with it. I don't have any issue with that running Slackware. So Slackware is capable, due to its simplicity, of doing some of the harder things easier than the other distributions, because they keep tripping over themselves with their own code bases, systemd, and whatnot, that's just causing them problems. Like their disk installers that were really hard to write. When you install Slackware, it is a very much human involved process. There's nothing that's really automatic or automated about it, very little anyway. So you have a lot of control over how you install the operating system to your laptop or your desktop, how you choose to do it and what you're going to install on, you know, how everything's going to work together. I mean, it offers the maximum amount of flexibility, and it's the easiest to use, in my opinion, even easier than Archer Gen 2 by far when it comes to installs or Void. It's much simpler to create a complex install environment with Slackware than any other distribution on the face of the planet. That's a fact. A final selling point on Slackware, if you're a developer, of course, it has probably the most serious and intensive number of developer tools and compilers of any distribution on the planet, which are installed as part of the base system if you install all the packages. It is as severe and as beefy and as battleship-like as OpenBSD is. OpenBSD, man, they provide you with everything. And I think Slackware actually beats OpenBSD because it has the LLVM Clang as well as it does the GCC compiler and all the goodies from GNU land. It's the best of all worlds. Slackware is the only Linux distribution that I'm aware of that gives you a full set of development tools upon install. Whether you're talking about Git or LLVM Clang or GCC or Fortran compiling or COBOL. COBOL's in there somewhere. I just compiled Mono the other night from Slack builds. You can get that. And of course, there's Java, all kinds of Java you can install. Yeah, you can really beef up a Slackware box, but the base install that you get off the DVD, it doesn't, I don't know if it has Java on or not. I know it doesn't have Mono, I don't think. But it's got probably more compilers and development tools and stuff on that than any of the other BSDs or Linuxes you can point to. It's funny, but Arch doesn't provide you with any development tools. You have to go download everything that you need. Gen 2 pretty much the same way, because Gen 2 will only bring forth a compiler or something if it needs it. It doesn't provide you with a complete layout, Perl and Python and everything. It doesn't give you Ruby or any of that stuff unless you build it and request it. Slackware gives you all of that stuff right off the DVD. From your first minute of using the operating system, you have a world of tools at your hands. And that's important, especially if you're using an operating system where you're going to be compiling all the software you're going to use. You're going to need all the compilers. You know, I really like the older generation of hardware, like this old Lenovo, because it's built so much better and the keyboard feels so much better. All the modern computers, in my opinion, they totally suck. I mean, they just suck outright. And that's not because they don't offer you a CD, DVD, reader-writer, even though that would be nice. They're trying to obsolete all that technology. Speaking of which, Slackware install media can be burned to a DVD. It's too big for a CD-ROM. Slackware 15, I believe, is the first release that doesn't offer CD-ROM images anymore. Those are gone, so you have to burn a DVD. Or you can just DD the entire image to a USB stick drive, a little thumbstick drive, and install it from that in either the 32-bit or 64-bit modes. So you have those two options, as well as creating a little tiny installer that will work off of the internet. If you have a network connection that you can install Slackware with, you can do that too. So in that regard, it covers everything that OpenBSD does in their installers, because OpenBSD will install from a hard drive if you have your base files on the hard drive. So will Slackware. It'll install from FTP or HTTP, HTTPS over the internet, or it'll install from a DVD drive, or of course, as I just mentioned, the USB thumbstick. You have several options that you can use to install Slackware Linux, and so it's very flexible with its hand-drawn installer. There are a few other issues I want to talk about. For instance, with Slackware, of course, you don't have systemd. It's the BSD init scripts, and they use their own version of UDEV that has been developed by other teams from other operating systems. Slackware doesn't actually develop any software, by the way. They just use the software that's available out on the internet and try to make it work with the next version of Slackware. And it's because they're continuing on supporting operating systems out there in the community that are not systemd based that I have firm belief that I don't think they'll ever eliminate 32-bit software either, for the same reason, because there are too many vendors that are going to provide you with chipsets and motherboards for machines that don't have UEFI that can run 32-bit software. And I predict it'll be around 20 years from now. It'll be like Spark boxes. You know, there'll be people that'll be able to get a machine that will run a 32-bit Slackware distribution 20 years from now. And I predict that's going to be true. The other thing I want to say that's good about 32-bit is it doesn't have the vulnerabilities that 64-bit Linux has with Spectre attacks, because they never did resolve the Spectre attack issue with all of the Intel chips, including the ones that's in this very Lenovo that I'm using. But if you're using a 32-bit version of Linux, you don't have to worry about it because you're not vulnerable. So this 32-bit version of Slackware, since I am a security-oriented person and I run OpenBSD, this 32-bit version of Slackware is actually safer to run than the 64-bit because of that. Because eventually, someday in the future, they'll exploit the Spectre vulnerabilities in all the processors, and this will become an issue for everybody that's not on an ARM chip. Because I believe ARM is the only one that is not vulnerable in a 64-bit version, because their CPU is designed a different way to not be vulnerable. But if you're running 32-bit Linux of any kind, whether it be Devwan or Slackware, or I don't think they make a 32-bit RHEL anymore. I think they discontinued that. But there may be a few other instances of 32-bit software, perhaps Gentoo. I don't know if Void Linux has a 32-bit or not. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. Can't remember. And Arch, I don't know. I'm not really up on Arch. But there are certainly a few software vendors that are still offering some 32-bit support. Slackware isn't the only one. And if you're running 32-bit Linux, you're in better shape against those kind of attacks than the 64-bit people are. OpenBSD is the only distribution that I'm aware of that has resolved that on a 64-bit issue. They're the only ones that cannot be attacked from a Spectre attack. OpenBSD, by the way, is also the only operating system in the world that has 64-bit time, which is also just jaw-dropping to me that no one else in all this time, in a decade, has even attempted to come up with their own 64-bit time in Linux. I'm assuming they're still working on it, but time is running out for you folks. The other thing I like about old Lenovo equipment or old IBM equipment is you can always get it rebuilt. You can either do it yourself or go to somebody and just pay to have it rebuilt. And I need to replace the DVD CD-ROM burner in this because it's quit working a few years ago. But other than that, I can expand the memory in this particular unit up to 16 gigabytes. It currently has only 6 gigabytes in it, which is more than enough to, you know, do what I need. You might ask why I didn't pull the Broadcom Wi-Fi out of here and change it out with something more compatible and generic. And that's because I'm worried that it might not boot, because a lot of the BIOSes were set up This particular box does have a UEFI switch in it. I could go to UEFI, but some of the laptops wouldn't boot if you changed out the Wi-Fi card. It just screwed with the BIOS enough that it wouldn't. And I don't know that this one is, this particular Lenovo is compatible with any of the free BIOSes that are out there, the two free BIOSes that are out there that can be installed on Lenovo hardware. Don't know that it is. This is an i5 based machine, by the way, which was at the time, I believe, the hottest chip you could buy. I don't think the i7 was available, or it was, the i7 would be fixing to come out a year or two after this thing was put out in the market. So the i5 was really the hottest chip for a laptop at that time. They probably had some i7s on the desktop, but I don't think they had any on the laptops. So, you know, if you're starting out in Linux, you could go out someplace and you know, used a computer equipment store or a garage sale or whatever, and find yourself one of these big ass, you know, 17-inch laptops, Lenovo, get a new battery for it. Have the keyboard replaced or rebuilt, cleaned out, you know, get a new DVD burner in it, have the CPU repasted, expand the memory on it. And they're great machines. I mean, the USB plugs on this thing, after all these years, are still tight. They work great, as opposed to the more modern machines where all the USB plugins, they get really loose, you know, and wobbly, and they're just horrible builds. You know, I don't even like the new Lenovo's because they don't use mechanical keyboards. They've got those bubble touch keyboards or whatever you want to call it, and they don't feel right. And, well, I understand that Lenovo's supposed to be making a new laptop that's based on the ThinkPad line from, you know, years ago, but I haven't heard any reviews on it or anything. Maybe somebody could do one if they have one and talk about it. But generally, I'm very depressed about all the new laptops and hardware. I mean, compared to the older laptops from 15 years ago, I don't see anything that really excites me or feels of quality, you know. And I'm not looking for the world's lightest laptop. I'm just looking for the one that's the best built, because that's the one that's going to last the longest. You know, carrying this dude around in a hammock bag as I walk out to the car and go over to a friend's house or whatever, no problem. I mean, it weighs more, but it's not like I'm carrying an anvil in a bag or something. You know, it's not that damn bad. So anyway, that's my talk about Slackware Linux and the Slackware 15 and 32-bit operating systems. And I hope I've been able to persuade at least a few of you to maybe go back to the old ways of the old squirrels. Goodbye for now.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HPR has been kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.